Welcome back to another edition of Dose of Reality Radio, everyone. I'm your host, Brian Stavely, along with my co-host, Justin Cook, and our special guest this week, Anthony Miguels. How you guys doing tonight?
Good evening, Justin, Brian.
Good to have you on, Anthony. Not bad, Brian. How you guys doing?
Doing good. Anthony, why don't you tell people a little bit about yourself and kind of what you're looking into?
Okay. I'm Anthony Michelsen from the Netherlands and involved in the, in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, I got involved in what is known as the Truth Movement. And when I started digging, into the backgrounds of this event, and I started to realize quickly that that there is this control structure, which is not just the government. It goes way beyond that, the secret government or whatever. And I started to realize that the financial industry was the core of all this. And that the world is basically run by the banking system and those behind the banking system. And so I started to dig into what money is and how money operates and how it works against us in this day and age, and how the money power, as I call the banking system and then its controllers, how they rule the world through finance and with boom bust cycle, with usury, with their scarce money, with a banking system that controls in what we can invest as a society. And that's kept me going ever since, because plenty of stuff to investigate there and more important to do about, because it's nice to talk about stuff, but at the end of the day you need to devise solutions. You can't just fearmonger every day and all day with because people will just get into a stupor. You need to provide real ideas of how you can move on. So I'm organizing a regional currency system here in the Netherlands, the Gelder, and it's the first regional currency in the Netherlands. And these things combined. So my blog, realcurrencies.wordpress.com, and this alternative currency that I operate. These things keep me busy.
Right. As I say, what made you decide to start looking into what the alternative media was feeding us, which is, pretty much the Austrian slant of things, as far as, the gold being the everything is so valuable with gold, and when did you start realizing that that was all a facade, what made you come to these conclusions?
Well, the gold thing was a facade was pretty clear to me quite early. But in the early stages of the Truth Movement, 2003, 2004, things were not so clear yet. There was a far more open debate on what actually was going on. It was only in the late 2000s that these libertarians got really, really entrenched in the alternative media and basically took over the whole show. For instance, a man like Alex Jones, whom I don't trust at all, who I never really trusted, he was not too clear on the monetary issue in the early stages of his career, I guess. And it's only in the last 5 or 6 years that he's come out entirely on the libertarian side and the Austrian economics side. And I think that the money power and the banking system and the mind controllers made a very dedicated effort to take over the alternative media, and I think that this has been going on for the last I think maybe 5 years or so, and of course especially in the 2008 campaign of Ron Paul. I mean, that was very important for the co-opting of the alternative media.
Right. I it makes me wonder, and I think going back to at least 1993 that we have evidence of, when G. Edward Griffin wrote The Creature of Jekyll Island, that there was some, that they were planning on having a movement and leading it astray. Can you explain, just off the top of your head, what are some of the the you know, what are the problems that you had with that book, and you know, and why, and whatnot, and how did that, you know, help lead these people towards these conclusions?
Yeah. Well, of course, libertarianism as a movement has been developing for decades. I think they really started libertarianism maybe in the late 40s or something like that, the Volcker Fund. And at Griffin is a very important issue because, you know, in the classical American populists, I think they were best represented by a man, Ezra Pound, and he went to Italy and started to do some radio shows there during the war, during the Second World War, in Italy, to explain to the American people that they were fighting the wrong war. And whether he was right about that remains to be seen, but he had a very clear paradigm, because he was saying the international banking system, Jewish supremacy, these things are real, and we are fighting for them. And fascism is anti-usury, anti-money power, anti-elitism. And after the war was over, obviously Ezra Pound, he got locked up in some mental ward in order to buy off a long-term prison sentence. And he trained Eustace Mullins in real history. And Eustace Mullins, he wrote that book, The Secrets of the Federal Reserve, in which he blew open the fact that the Federal Reserve Bank is a privately controlled institution. And Ezra Pound put him on the right track, and he went into the Library of Congress and figured it all out. And that's a famous book and a legendary book. And but this was, I think, a real problem for libertarianism in general. And I think that is the reason why they had Ed Griffin write that book, the Secrets of, what's it called again? The Creature of Jekyll Island.
Right.
Yeah. And because the problem with that book is that, you know, it basically rehashes the Eustace Mullins narrative of a privately owned Federal Reserve Bank. But whereas Eustace Mullins was absolutely, completely clear about gold standard, the gold as money being an elitist meme, and that the previous gold standards of the early 20s, let alone in the 19th century, that these were all bank-controlled gold standards, Ed Griffin all of a sudden provides a gold standard as a solution to a predicament of a privately controlled Federal Reserve Bank.
Right.
So this is complete. It's a complete fraud. It's clear that he is plagiarizing Eustace Mullins big time. But in terms of solutions, all of a sudden he seems to have forgotten that he's actually ripping off this book, and he comes up with this gold standard nonsense,
right,
betraying everything that Ezra Pound and Eustace Mullins stood for. So this is really a very disgraceful piece of work.
All right. Yeah. So, you know, we're talking about Eustace Mullins, you know, and Ezra Pound, of course, and you know, and the whole fraud of the Creature of Jekyll Island. Now, I just want to bring up something quickly before we go forward, and that's the thing that Alex Jones, if he actually names Eustace Mullins as one of his mentors, you know, as the guy that he, you know, supposedly got into this, you know, into the truthing business from. So, I mean, it's really ironic that, you know, that this guy, that he would go, you know, pretty much against what this guy is saying and towards the John Birch Society, Volcker Fund, you know, backed, you know, Edward Griffin. So, I mean, I think that's something that's, you know, definitely clear and obviously, a ploy. I mean, continue on as you're breaking down the creature.
Well, you know, it's good that you mentioned that, because it just shows how important Eustace Mullins actually was. He died a few years back, of course, so we can't really express our admiration for what he has given us, because I think that the truth movement without Eustace Mullins is simply unthinkable. And but on the other hand, this book, Secrets of the Federal Reserve, created a real problem for the money power. And it was really, for them, very important to create, you know, a blind alley to lead the people in, because otherwise the truth movement would have been dominated by Eustace Mullen's ideas and Ezra Pound's ideas. And Ezra Pound, of course, was in favor of cheaper paper money, but then interest free, so not the usurious nonsense that that the banking system provides us with today. But and it also shows, you know, how long term these people think, because it's basically brilliant. I mean, they had Griffin write this book in 1993, when all this was basically still very irrelevant. Of course, you had these fringe nuts in the United States that were, you know, actually critical of the federal government. And but I remember at the time as a young guy, okay, I'm still pretty young, but as a kid at the time, I was looking at the militias as some complete nutters, you know. But nowadays, of course, they are pretty much involved in the truth movement, and everybody takes it much more seriously because everybody is seeing that the federal government is a great scourge, and it's probably controlled by an internationalist movement. So
totally. You know, you mentioned something, and I just want you to get into something now. You know, now what are the major flaws of usury, and why do you know, besides the fact of them having an agenda that belongs with the elite, you know, why would they front a system that is, you know, and defend usury so hard? That's, you know, to me, it's counterproductive. It makes no sense.
Yeah, well, the usury, of course, is so incredibly entrenched in our mindset. I mean, 10 years ago, before I started to wake up to these things, it was just, you know, I mean, you take it as a matter of fact. Eh? I mean, you go into a bank and you take out a mortgage for 30 years, and you don't even calculate what it costs, and that's where the problems begin. But once you start doing that, you realize that for a 200K mortgage in 30 years, you will be paying $300,000 in interest. And that's an incredible amount of money for a normal working class guy like myself. I mean, that's 10 years work, you know, and that's just for the mortgage. And that's a major problem, and there are major problems with that for several reasons. In the first place, once you start figuring out fractional reserve banking and the current banking system, you start to realize that all this money that you take out with a mortgage, that the bank doesn't have this money, and that it creates it at the moment you borrow it. So so this 300,000, that's insane. You know, you go into a bank, you take out a mortgage for $200,000, and they just print the money at the moment you take out the loan. Thin air money, a five-minute computer program operation, and then you start paying $300,000 in interest over 30 years, $10,000 per year. I mean, that's if you just let that sink in, that really is a very grave situation indeed, and it only starts there because the problem is that even if you don't take out a mortgage and you start hiring a place, renting a place, then of course you'll be paying the mortgage into the interest for the mortgage that the landlord is paying.
Exactly.
So you know, even though you have no debts at all, you will still be paying interest for capital costs that people are incurring in providing you with services. For instance, the landlord, but also simply industrial goods and services. These nowadays, when you start up a business, when you start up producing something, you have to finance the whole lot before you can before you actually start making money. And this is usually done with banking loans, and these producers, these suppliers, they need to pay interest on these loans, and they pass on this interest through prices. And it transpires that about 45% of prices nowadays are related to cost for capital. So consider this: if you have no debt at all, you still lose 45% of your disposable income to interest because your suppliers are passing on the interest costs they make through prices. And that's very important. So 45% of our income has gone to interest even if we have no debt at all. And then there is the final major issue with interest. Clearly, the poor borrow and the rich lend. It's as simple as that, and everybody can understand this immediately. The poor don't have money, and the rich do, so the poor have to go into debt with the rich, and then they start paying interest to the rich over these loans. So in Germany, they have quantified this redistribution of wealth that this entails, and it transpires that the 80% of the population, the poorest 80% of the population, pay more interest than they receive to the richest 10% of the population, and the next richest they pay as much as they receive. So the 80% of the people, the poorest 80%, so that's basically everybody, the entire working class and most of the middle class, are paying interest to the richest 10%. And it transpires that in Germany alone, there are no figures for the rest of the world, but in Germany they have calculated how much this wealth transfer really is. They have calculated that in Germany alone, €1 billion per day are being paid by the poorest 80% to the richest 10%. So that's a grand total of €365 billion per year being paid by the poor to the rich. Well, obviously, Germany is a big economy, but if we take that to the United States, and it's absolutely fair to say that it's basically the same situation in the States. It means that the poorest 80% are paying anywhere between $1 and $2 trillion per year in interest to the richest 10%. And then just let that sink in, you know. I mean, $1 to $2 trillion per year in interest paid by the poorest 80%. For the poorest 50% of Americans have zero assets or less. They are paying up to $2 trillion per year to the richest 10%. And, well, obviously, this is an insane situation. I mean, it means that most of the people are just working to pay off their interest costs, either for their mortgages or their usury that is passed on through prices. And people have absolutely no idea that this is going on. The first time that people hear this, they just can't even process the information because it's so big.
They think you're crazy when you tell them.
They must.
It's such a big setup to just keep the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer, and it's like...
That's what I'm saying.
It's totally ass backwards. And the interest is so high where even if you don't pay your mortgage, let's say after a couple of years, you've already paid them enough in interest where they come and take the house back. It's still worth it to them to take the risk.
Yeah. And they do, because these people are completely ruthless. I mean, they don't pay and lose everything. You know, it's as simple as that.
Right.
So this is usury, and it's massive. We're talking about worldwide. We're talking about $5 to $10 trillion per year that the poorest 80% are paying to the richest 10. And it's even worse, gentlemen, because it transpires that even in the top 10% bracket, so the richest 10%, the 8% poorest of the 10% richest people of the population, pay more interest than they receive to the richest 1%. So the rich are paying the even richer. And this means that the money is moving up ever higher on the food scale. And eventually it all ends up at the very top.
Right.
And this is the horror of interest. It all ends up with the ultra rich.
You know, and that's the thing I always say to people when I'm just trying to explain just the bare minimum of how the economy works. And I say, you know, where do you think that all these debts go? How is it possible that the whole world is in debt? Who is the debt to? You know, of course, obviously it's to the people that own the private banks. But, but to a normal person, that's one of the big things with this so-called clown show election that's going on, and they're talking about the debt and this debt, you know, and this and that with the debt. But in reality, you know, the debt is going into the Rothschilds' pockets. It's going into the Vatican. It's, you know, it's not like we. I believe the Federal Reserve even bought up most of China's debt. You know, that we owed to them. So I mean, it's just a total shell game.
Yeah.
Oh, and they have total control of the media too. So and the textbooks that you read in school, or even at a higher education like a college or something. And,
absolutely.
You know, it's like it's so hard, you know, to make people think the other way because they've been brought up their whole lives, you know, believing that's the way the system's supposed to work and that's the American dream and all that. And it's a bunch of bull.
Yeah. And especially capitalism. I mean, every self-respecting American will call himself a capitalist. But the fact is that capitalism is a system where the capitalists dominates labor and capital is controlled by a very small amount of people, and labor is just the rest of us sweating our butts off to pay off this all this interest, and that's what it's all about. And we're just so mind-controlled into, you know, accepting this system as completely normal. And I speak a lot with people trying to explain to them, you know, the problems of interest, but especially all these Austrian economists. I mean, you know, if I chat with people online via Facebook or via my blog or other blogs, they are so vociferous in defending the right of the rich to ask for interest. You know, they want interest. And then I ask them, okay, so what do you make? You know, what is your asset position? And 99% of these guys will tell me, oh, I own shit. You know, absolutely nothing. So they're just explaining to me why the rich have the right to just basically rip them off.
Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's the thing about it. It's amazing that so many people are, you know, well, here, let's get into this instead of my diatribe. Well, you know, Eustace Mullins mentioned a system called social credit. And I know that you also back this as well as, you know, like you said, you have the GELRA, is that pronounced right?
Yeah, the GELRA, yeah.
Yes. You know, yeah. So, I mean, we have, you know, we do have small competing you know, currencies that you know, people are looking to get off the ground. Like we had Wayne Walton on last week, who was mm-hmm. Talking about his mountain hours. You know, as social credit, how is that? Why don't you explain that to everybody, pretty much?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, there. You know, the wider picture is the wider issue is that you know how should we reform the monetary system? What do we really need? And the libertarians are telling us that the problem with our money is that it is paper-based, it is not asset-backed, and this is the problem according to them. And the other issue is that it is, according to the Austrians, which is basically an outrageous lie, that we have government money, which is absolutely untrue. Of course, a government creates a currency monopoly, but what they try to hide is that this currency monopoly is handed over to a private banking cartel. Which then proceeds to rip us off with this interest-bearing paper money. So the wider issue is who should be issuing the money. That's a crucial issue. And the other issue is how expensive is this money going to be? So is it going to be interest-free? That's the basic question. And I think it's fair to say that the currency monopolies must go. I don't believe that, you know, that we should have a government standard which is the only currency circulating. I think that if market players can provide units that are, you know, better than what government can offer, then obviously they should be allowed to do so. There's absolutely no reason why they shouldn't. And I think the basic idea of the basic paradigm should be that if the market can do it, well, then it should. On the other hand, obviously, money is of such a crucial importance. The government can absolutely not allow the market to mess it up. And obviously, Austrians believe that that only the market can provide that for anything real. But that's completely outrageous. I mean, markets are dominated by the rich and always have been. And so this free market is ideology. This extreme free market here ideology of the Austrians is way over the top and basically just a belief system, and it's absolutely not backed up by facts or a practical observation. And so I think that the government should provide a basic standard, and probably the best way to go for government is with social credit. And what is social credit then? Basically, it's just paper money printed by the government, but instead of spent into circulation by the government itself, the government hands over the cash to the people on an equal footing. So every man gets the same amount, every woman gets the same amount, and they spend it into circulation. And that's social credit. So it's a very democratic system because basically everybody is sharing in the... everybody's sharing equally in the proceeds of this. And even if there are problems, for instance, with inflation, which is basically always what the Austrians are complaining about, hyperinflation, and the government will always print too much, blah, 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 blah. This is not really an issue with social credit because people are the inflation that the government is creating by printing new cash is it's all handed over to the people themselves. So the entire inflatory pressure is spent into circulation by the people who are supposedly being ripped off by this inflation. So they're completely fully compensated by definition by social credit, and of course because the people are the ones that are profiting from the inflation. The government actually has no incentive to provide inflation. They will all, the government has a clear incentive to just provide stable prices because nobody really gains from inflation or really loses. So that's why social credit is a very powerful system. It is a government unit, but it is not a monopoly. Well, it could be a monopoly, but I'd say it's not necessary for it to be a monopoly. And it's very, and it decentralizes power because the purchasing power of the new money is with the people themselves.
But what would you do with something like, say, how you would divide it amongst all the people evenly? But then, so even somebody that's like a doctor is going to get the same amount as somebody that like works at Dunkin' Donuts. Like
it's yeah.
So there could end up being a lot of people that kind of try and be lazy from it. You know what I mean? And not really strive to get a better job if they know they're just going to get the same amount anyways.
Yeah, well, that's problem? Yeah, well, that's you know, that's an often heard complication that people think of, and I think you must understand that the social credit will provide people with a basic income, but it will not make you rich. I mean, you know, you'll be able to pay the rent perhaps and maybe eat, but then it won't be much more than that. So people will have a very strong incentive to find jobs to increase this income.
In other words, what Anthony's saying is you would start out with this. That's not what you would earn down the road. You would be able to earn according to your means. It's pretty much like taking a stimulus and dividing it among the people and saying you could do what you want. You can buy a business with this if you want. You could do this if you want. Type thing. In other words, instead of taking, the stimulus and giving it all to the banks for them to loan out interest.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, let's face it. Yeah, I think we should explore this a little bit more. But come on, Brian. What do you have a question?
Yeah, it slipped my mind for a second though. No, I'm sorry about that. Oh, so do you think so? Like. If something like this were to get going, but like let's say everybody collected $500 a week, just for like a number, let's just use that, out of this new money that was printed and given to the people. When they go and work at their jobs, would a lot of their jobs still be paying them in Federal Reserve notes, and there'd be a combination of the two, and eventually try and work it just to social credit? Is that the idea?
No, I think that if we would start working this new system, we would be looking to replace the Federal Reserve notes and get them out of the circulation slowly and with the newly printed cash. So for every dollar that is newly printed via social credit, all the dollars would go out of circulation.
Okay.
Yeah. And let me explore a little bit more about this issue of people work, because what I think is important to understand, and which I think very 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 few people actually realize, is that in the Middle Ages in Europe, when there was no usury, and the Catholic Church forbade usury, and there was absolutely interest bearing loans were a capital crime, and a working man at the time worked for about 14 weeks per year, and he could feed his entire family from that for the rest of the year.
Wow.
So, yeah, and I mean, that's really what it's all about, isn't it? I mean, if we can work for 15 weeks per year, feed our family with that, and have plenty of time left for traveling. I mean, people call this the Dark Ages, eh? But there were no dark ages. We were building cathedrals all over the place. I mean, of course, not in the United States because they were not there yet. But obviously, everybody knows about these grandiose structures that that these primitive people of the 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th century Europe were actually building all over the place. They were building it in the smallest of villages. They were building absolutely marvelous structures. And often these structures were under construction for decades, actually, some of them actually longer than a century. And how is this possible, you know? In this day and age, if you start a construction process, it must be done in the shortest time possible, because once you start building, you start indebting yourself with the bank, and every year you're paying 5 to 10% over this loan. And you know, if you continue this loan for 100 years, I mean, the cost for capital would be completely insane. They would be unbearable. So it's undoable. But in the Middle Ages, they had this time and they had this opportunity to just build and build and build and create structures that, you know, small cities with a few thousand people that created really brilliant cathedrals. It's completely unheard of nowadays. And how is this possible? Because the working man had 30 years per week to just be busy with that, you know, or to travel the rest of the continent to see cathedrals elsewhere, to study and have a good time with his family. So that's the promise. That's what we are looking at. And so it's not true to say that that people should work or work, because this is the slavery kind of mindset that we are being programmed with. I mean, we feel lousy if we don't work 8 hours a day because we think we fail and are just lazy assholes, you know. And this is what the rich have managed us to make us believe. But of course, this is not why we are here. We're not here to slave away 8 hours a day for some rich capitalists from London, you know.
Right. Now explain. You know. Now, so in other words, people, you know, the more you work, yes, the more you would make. But what we're talking about here is we're having, right now, we have, you know, we have poor, we have middle class, and we have rich, and then we have elite. You know what I mean? So pretty much what it would do would be to get rid of the elite and get rid of the lower class, to where everybody's middle class, or, you know, and some people that, you know, are doctors or have higher things, they would be, you know, more of the upper middle class. And there's plenty, you know, to go around for everybody is pretty much what it is. We wouldn't have guys like Bill Gates, you know, with how many trillions of dollars, and yet people are starving because, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. So it's not like, you know, as far as we're socialism, where no matter what your job is, you get paid the same amount of money. That's
absolutely not. And this has nothing to do with socialism. Socialism is the other side of the spectrum. It's, you know, both capitalism and socialism are inventions of the same elite. This is what we call the dialectic. And it has absolutely nothing to do with socialism. And socialism is complete tyranny. And everybody in his right mind just rejects that.
Right. Just wanted to make that clear for the listeners.
Yeah, yeah. The chat made a good point too that I wanted to bring up real quick, Father. And they said that in over the last, you know, few years or whatever, the interest rates that you actually get on money that you deposit at the banks have, you know, pretty much been cut in half. So, like, you know, it used to be thought that if you put $1 million away in the bank, you could live off the interest, and, you know, that would never happen nowadays.
No, that's true, but obviously we live in a boom-bust kind of economy, yeah? So the banking system first inflates the economy. This has been going on in the 90s and the early 2000s. And then everybody gets into debt, and the economy presumably grows as a result of the credit boom. And then they tighten the credit situation, so they don't provide credit. The banks at this point, they have a great difficulty lending, not because they don't have money, but because they don't want to. And then people are being starved for credit, starved for cash. And okay, we have low interest rates, but it's very difficult to get a decent loan on a decent conditions at this point. But this is always a temporary situation. At some point, things clear up. Okay, we have a grave crisis at our hands this time. They want to change the monetary system itself. They want to get rid of the current paradigms and then move on to new systems, and maybe international systems or goal-based systems. But first we will have deflation and depression for years to come, which is associated with low interest rates.
Right. Someone in the chat was just saying, yeah, the interest rates for bank deposits have also halved since the recession. It was once possible to maybe save $1 million in the bank and live off the interest, but it's not really possible anymore. By the time you save that much to do it, it won't be worth that much. Yeah, no, I think, you know, you'd agree. It's just totally because of, you know, how they've gone and, you know, and been, you know, totally, you know, made it impossible for people to make a living by driving everything up and wages staying down and everything else. I don't know. I just figured I'd, you know, if you wanted to address that, go ahead.
Yeah, well, the issue is that, I was just saying that the interest rates are low because of all sorts of artificial factors. But the issue is if you are a millionaire, it's wonderful to be a millionaire, but why do you want to put it into a bank and hope it will automatically become more? And where is this money that you're living off, where is it actually coming from? It's quite simple. It's coming from working people who are indebting themselves for their mortgage, and who are paying the capital costs that they incur through prices. And it's the poor that actually pay this life of leisure for the millionaire. So it's actually a good thing that interest rates are low and that this is no longer at this point feasible, although it will return without a doubt at a later stage.
Right. I'm trying to think if there's anything else you wanted to talk about on this. If not, I wanted to get into. So, you know, lately you guys have set up a new website called the Daily Knell, which you and Mem Hunter are a part of and have been going after. Now, the Daily Bell and Gary North and these guys. Now, it's true that you guys actually have been breaking their balls so much that they've shut down the comment section. And now have you challenged them to debates, and what are the answers that you get for the, you know?
Yeah. Well, indeed, the Daily Knell is an offshoot basically of a process that we have started late last year. And Meme Hunter was following my blog at the time at the Real Currencies, realcurrencies.wordpress.com, and just making a bit of advertisement for my blog here, if you don't mind. And
advertise all your blogs, man. we're gonna give them out after, but either way, anytime you want to plug something, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. So. He was following the discussion of Meme Hunter was interested in my opposition to the gold standard, which was just starting to develop at the time, because I'd been following this surge of the libertarians and Austrian economics for years, and I'd been wondering for years, hey, where's Bill Still, where's Alan Brown, why are these people just not murdering these Austrians and explaining in the most simple terms why this is all nonsense, you know. But obviously, well, they tried, but it's, you know, it's if it, the billions being poured into libertarianism each year. So, I started to look at the Daily Bell, which is obviously a leading outlet, especially in terms of brain power, because I don't think they aim at the lowest common denominator of libertarianism. They're actually creating ideas there. And I started looking into this website, and I started to discuss a few items with them, especially the usury item, because the usury item is so big, it's so important, it's actually the absolute core of the whole monetary system, the whole monetary theory. It's the core of Keynesianism, of Austrianism, of each and every elite-sponsored economic theory. Either they ignore it, or they propose, or they try to downplay it. They try to explain that we absolutely cannot do without, and it's all nonsense. We can easily do without, but and this is with Austrian economics also very much the case. If you start discussing interest with Austrians, you'll find that they're pretty aggressive in defending it, and they always have the same arguments. They're always saying, well, there is this time factor. You know, if I lend out money, I cannot use it myself, and therefore I need to be compensated. They always use this, and they always you know, they basically disconnect when you explain to them that that the poor are paying 5 to 10 trillion per year on a worldwide scale, and that it is a wealth transfer per definition from the poor to the rich. And but you know, the money power rules through these through control of the money supply, and they use this control to tax us with interest, and that is the core issue. And then when I started to discuss this with the Daily Bell, well, it really was very interesting, because it's not just usury, it's also money power, because libertarians, of course, they are always complaining about government, you know? It's always the government that is at fault for everything. And of course, especially if you are in the United States, but also in Europe, I mean, the government is a complete asshole. I mean, we can all agree right on that. It's a horror, but we also must understand that all government is controlled from behind the scenes by the banking industry and the controllers of that business, and there is no independent government, there is no democracy, there is only a network of extremely wealthy businessmen with silly secret societies like these stupid Freemasons with their hand signs and Malteser Knights and Le Cercle and you know, all these elite old boys networks,
right?
Basically you know, having a good time together, screwing expensive hookers and you know, drinking expensive wine, and then ruling the world in between,
and molesting little boys and whatnot.
Yeah, that's a very important part of it also, just obviously how could we do without. And yeah, so these libertarians are blaming the state, but it's obvious that the state is controlled by these elitist networks. And if you're turning a blind eye to that, you're basically just you know, framing the debate and trying to mind control people into attacking a basically viable and you know, basically justifiable institution. Even though we very much agree that the current federal government or the European Union or the British government are just complete maniacs. I mean, there's no doubt about that. So that's another issue: usury, state versus money power. A third issue is the boom-bust cycle. Austrian economists, they are very proud that they have this theory on the boom-bust cycle: credit expansion first, and then what they call malinvestment and unavoidable deflation of the money supply and deleveraging. But the real truth is that, true, there are credit bubbles. I mean, this is how they operate the banking system. But the real issue is that they want a boom-bust cycle. It's not a natural phenomenon. It's not an implicit problem of the system. It is that they want a boom-bust cycle. They first want to inflate and to have everybody start investing with optimism. And then they want to deflate and deleverage, crashing asset prices so that they can buy up everything for pennies on the dollar and use the mayhem that they're causing with such depressions to create other phenomena such as wars and power centralizations in supranational organizations and stuff like that. So the boom-bust cycle, as explained by Austrian economics, is nonsense. It's just purposeful manipulation, and that they'd use credit expansion for that is, well, interesting, but not really not the core issue. Okay, so I was discussing this with the Daily Bell, and you talked to these people about this stuff, and then you start to realize they don't care about the truth. You know, they are just trying to score points. They are just trying to convince me that I'm right, that I'm wrong, and that they are right. And, you know, I don't care about being right. If somebody comes with a better story than mine, I'm just learning, you know? That's what I want to hear. I don't need to be right. I couldn't care about being right. I mean, it's about growing. It's about finding out what is governing this world, you know? What kind of logic, what kind of narrative is actually running this world, and we need to find out the truth.
That's the problem with a lot of people. They can't admit that they were wrong. You got to be able to admit you were wrong a bunch of times. You're never going to grow, and you're never going to learn.
Exactly.
I've been wrong so many times, but you got to be willing to look at everything and just discern through it and see what's real and see what's bullshit. You know.
Yeah. That's how you get better.
You know, and here's the thing too is, you know, like you say, these guys, you know, the libertarian capitalists or whatever, you know, they hate the state so bad, but yet they voted for Republic. You know, they went all out for yeah. Republican this year. And I mean, if that doesn't show just the hypocrisy of what we're seeing yeah. here, you know, a guy who won't even admit 9/11 was an inside job.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, and has talked about globalism is not a bad thing. I thought that this was an anti-globalist movement. I thought that was part of the goal here. But it's obviously, to them, it's not a bad thing as long as it's backed by, you know, gold and silver. You know, and to me, that was one of the red flags. I think that, you know, that brought me down the road of of researching your work and a lot of these other guys. How do you feel about the greenback solution?
Yeah, well, the greenback it's a little bit complex because in the first place, the greenback as first issued by Abe Lincoln was not what it appears to be. The greenback, let me put it this way, to frame the issue. The greenback, as most people understand it, is a debt-free government-printed currency. So the government just slaps some ink on paper and says this is $1. And starts buying stuff with it, and as a result of that, the money starts to circulate, and they accept it for tax payments, and this is how the economy is then financed. And ostensibly, Abe Lincoln invented the greenback and financed the Civil War with it. It transpired, however, that the greenback actually was not debt free. In fact, the greenback itself was backed by interest-bearing bonds, and these bonds were issued by the same London bankers that Abe Lincoln apparently, according to many people, tried to circumvent. So this is a bit of a ruse. In fact, it's a big, major ruse, and we should be blowing that out of the water. But the real issue is, could the government print the currency debt-free, interest-free, and spend it in circulation? I'd say yes, it could. It should. It's far better to do that than create a monopoly. And
But the whole problem is the money power behind it anyway. So no matter what's going on, we have to get rid of the money power pretty much until, you know.
Well, that's a bit of a problem because, for instance, if you now say that the federal government should print its own money, I mean, the federal government, the American empire, clearly is an internationalist tool. And obviously, if the government would start printing its own money, it would save $450 billion in interest payments to the money power. That's a good thing. But on the other hand, the American Empire is a complete maniac, and they would probably buy even more stealth fighters and start colonizing space, militarizing space with I don't know what. But if they haven't already, by the way, but. So I think it's fair to say that even if they have interest-free money nowadays, the American government, would not really solve anything at this point.
Now, what would you, you know, because I think, you have somewhat allies in the Bill Stills and the, you know, Alan Browns and Stephen Zarlanga, but, you know, is that where, in your mind, that's where they go wrong, or?
Well, I appreciate these people, you know, and I feel far closer to them than to libertarians, and you know, because the simple fact is that they do promote interest-free alternatives, and it is very much more rational for the government to print its own money than to have an international banking cartel do it for them, with all the interest costs that entails. But I do feel that at this point, a strongly centralized money supply, even as in the form of an interest debt-free greenback, still entails risk because the American empire is so highly centralized and is such a scourge for the world. I mean, just look at what they're doing in the Middle East. I mean, it's really very, very dangerous. And I think that we should go further, and that's why I like social credit. Because then it's not the government that is using the purchasing power of the money, it's the people themselves, and I think people themselves. Okay, you guys in the United States, you would be buying a few guns for yourself, but only to protect the wife and kids, and not to get into some kind of a silly arms race. So. You know, normal people would just buy normal stuff and not empire.
Right. Yeah, I think we're gonna take a break now. So I don't know. Might as well go and grab a drink if you want or whatever. Oh, well, we were just talking pretty much about the Marxist, Mises, dialect and whatnot, and pretty much talking about, you know, just the, the idea of social credit. And I don't know, Anthony, whereabouts were you at when we stopped? I'm trying to think.
Like you were saying, and I was talking about the greenback and whether this is a viable solution for our monetary problems. And we were saying that debt-free American government money at this point, well, while being better than Federal Reserve notes, it could be a risk because of the American empire that they are running and how dangerous that is. And if they could finance that interest free, debt-free, that they would probably buy even more guns, and that this is a real issue.
Right. Let's say, if anyone else wants to ask a question, get one ready or whatever. I just wanted to say, pretty much across the alternative media, you know, everybody is pushing this buy gold thing and everything else. Now, let me ask you a question now. For the people that are at the top, that have all the gold, you know, and we've heard the Ed Griffin remark that, you know, there's still gold to be mined and everything. And in my opinion, that's what the last 10 years have been about with these wars, is sewing up the last few places in the Middle East and whatnot that have gold reserves and everything. You know, pretty much, what is the dangers of the gold standard besides, you know, the fact that that the gold is in the hands of so few? You know, why is
What you're saying is of course absolutely correct, and I don't think we can stress that enough. So let me first get into that a bit. The simple fact is that, you know, gold is in the hands of the international banking cartel that we want to get rid of. So why in the world would we want to get into a gold standard where the money supply would still be controlled by the same people? I mean, that's insane. And this is the issue with Austrian economics, because the Austrians they explain to us this is why we have cooperated with them forever in the truth movement. They are saying, well, fractional reserve banking is a crime. They print all this money out of nothing and they rape us with interest. And then the Austrians, by a man like Gary North, he actually wrote a book on this called Coogan's Bluff, by the way, and. He goes on to explain in this book. So we need to end fractional reserve banking, and we need to end non-backed loans. We will feel a lot better, he explains to us, if we can pay all this interest over a gold-based loan, a fully backed gold-based loan, and we will feel better if we can all pay all this interest, if we can pay it in gold coin, instead of just saying the bloody obvious that if the money is created for absolutely nothing out of absolutely nothing, we should get it for absolutely nothing, interest-free, thus, huh? That is the real issue. And so this whole gold thing, you know, controlled by the ultra-rich, being still able to rape us with interest, so maintaining this wealth transfer of 5 to 10 trillion per year, that's the real problem. And the other issue is, which can also not be, we really need to stress this also, gold will undoubtedly lead to an excruciating deflation, and that's a major problem. We have seen time and again in history that the international banking clan they use deflations and depressions to create tension in society, and from that tension they build wars, and that's what they want. They want tension, war, especially in the Middle East. And obviously, the United States at this point is their prime target. They want to destroy the United States as the standing superpower in the world, and they need to destroy the American economy to do that. And they need a massive deflation, and that's why they want gold is a very good means of a very good way of doing that, because there will never be enough gold to circulate, and they can easily deflate a gold-based money supply. And that's why they're doing this.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think we, you know, we're all, you know, we all realize that that's the eventual goal here is to, you know, to make America so broke that we end up going to a global system here, which is, you know, eventually the New World Order, which is, you know, the one world dictatorship that we've all heard so much about. You know, and getting back to the gold, though, you know, it's you know, it, yes, it has intrinsic value and everything, but, you know, these people, it's come to a worship thing and everything. Now, someone like Ron Paul.
But even that's sorry to interrupt you, Justin. Yeah. But even this intrinsic value thing is just a complete ruse. I mean, nowadays, even people like Gary North, they must admit that this is complete nonsense. Because let's face it, in the early 2000s, gold was worth $200 an ounce. Now it's doing $2,000 an ounce, and in a few years it will be doing $20,000 an ounce. So where's the intrinsic value? There is no intrinsic value. There's only market value.
Right, like everything else, it's you know, the scarcity arguments and everything else that they use, just like with diamonds and oil and everything else that they've been doing. What I was gonna say is you know, the people that are holding, you know, all this gold and everything, how would they, you know, a person like Ron Paul, how would he would actually benefit? And in my understanding, gold would pretty much become a fiat currency. You know, if you want to talk fiat like the Austrians do, am I saying that correct? Pretty much.
Gold and fiat are related for the simple fact that in the gold standards of yesterday, there was always more gold-based paper in circulation than there was actual gold. So banks always have lent out more gold, paper, than they actually had gold in their vaults. And so that's eventually leads to, you know, basically degenerates the gold into a fiat standard. And the Austrian economists of today, they have they suggest that the gold should be fully backed by gold, so that the bank should not be allowed to create non-backed paper. But in all fairness, they do not provide a mechanism with which they could guarantee that banks would no longer print more paper, gold-backed paper, than they would actually have gold in their in their vaults, and it can hardly be done. It's impossible to guarantee it.
Right. You know, and what I was going to say is, you know, it's just insane, though. I mean, because, you know, we've seen this so much, you know, and I can't say it enough, but with the alternative media, that everywhere you go, it's, you know, it's buy gold and buy gold, and now, so eventually, are these people going to make out that actually bought gold, or are they you know, are they in for you know, are they going to be hurting like the rest of us? I mean, obviously, I know when the economy collapses, you can't eat gold, you know. Mm-hmm. So I mean, but you know, as far as like the ones that are holding a good amount of it, is that, you know, how is you know, well, if they all have it, who's going to want it? I guess is another thing too.
Yeah. You know, I've been in the forecasting business for quite a while now, and I can tell you this, I usually get it wrong, because, you know, these guys are just so shrewd in their long-term planning, and it's really very difficult to, in real time, to really dig their intentions and their goals. But I do think it's fair to say that they're clearly moving towards gold-based currencies. I mean, the euro was designed to be ultimately backed by gold. You hear of all these international gold, supranational gold-based units. There's speculation. What?
Was the Bancor or something like that? Is that what they were going for?
The Bancor was the international unit as opposed by John Maynard Keynes at the time, at the time of Bretton Woods. I think there was gold involved in that originally as well. But they are moving to with the IMF. They use the special drawing rights, and that is a prototype of international world currency, and there is discussion that could be backed by gold. But you also have, for instance, the Russians and the Chinese and the Indians now now discussing paying for Iranian gold, Iranian oil with gold, settling international trade with gold. You know, there is in the United States we have libertarianism and Ron Paul. Nowadays, the Republican convention just recently decided to investigate gold as currency to install a gold board or a, how do you call this, a gold commission. And so it's quite clear that internationally, worldwide, there's a clear movement in the direction of gold. And this also explains why gold is appreciating, because people are saying, under the influence of the Austrians and the alternative media, that gold is appreciating because everybody is fearing hyperinflation. Well, there is no hyperinflation. There is only a massive deflation. If you look at the money supply worldwide, it's crashing big time. And prices are going down, at least asset prices are going down, both stocks and real estate. And so there is a massive deflation and there is no inflation. Of course, it's more complicated than that because, for instance, oil prices are rising. But maybe we can get into that a little later. But the real issue is deflation. So why is gold rising? Normally speaking, in a deflationary environment, gold should be going down also. It is not. It is now 10 times more expensive than it was just 10 years ago. And why is this? Because the people are speculating it will be money again. And this is why gold is getting more expensive. And this is why gold will probably continue to appreciate for the time being.
Right. I was going to say, you know, the other thing that comes to mind with all this is, you know, the whole fact of all the people right now that have a vested interest in this and are pushing for, you know, a gold standard. We have Alan Greenspan, we have the head of the IMF, we have George Soros, Paul Ryan. All these people have, you know, a vested interest in getting a gold standard, and you know that's why, you know, obviously in all who's the head of the IMF?
Lagarde, Christiane Lagarde.
Zelik, Robert Zelik?
That's the World Bank.
The World Bank, sorry, correct, yeah. Yeah, he's also advocating for the for a gold standard. So, I mean, you know, anyone can look and see that, you know, that these people are puppets for the elite, if not elite themselves. You know, why would we want to follow in something that they're advocating?
Absolutely, and, you know, if you look at this Ron Paul character, I mean, his asset position, he owns about 5 million in assets. It's all in gold. So he stands to gain a really big deal, a great deal from ever rising gold prices. And, you know, people, when it comes to Ron Paul, people say, oh, that's because he puts his money where his mouth is and it's the conviction of his beliefs and blah, 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 blah. But if you're a congressman like these other crooks, you know, and they invest in wink wink in Merck or in GlaxoSmithKline, and then push all sorts of vaccination bills through Congress, and see how their shares rise because of that, then it's all of a sudden it's a vested interest, you know. So. Obviously, there's a great hypocrisy going on here, and Ron Paul is just a special interest candidate, just like all the rest. But in this particular instance, it's gold that he's pushing, and that is the specie of the day, and people love gold, so he's our hero, you know?
Right. Now, you know, and here's the thing some of the people might not understand is some of the people behind Ron Paul and some of the organizations. Like we've said, we said Edward Griffin, who's a member of the John Birch Society, and of course, Ron Paul's also, you know, very friendly with them, if not a member. Also very, you know, very close to the CNP, the Council for National Policy, and you know, and like you said, the Volcker Fund, and which is the Koch brothers and Koch brothers is the real way to say it, but I call them the Koch brothers. You know, and all this, you know. So I mean, I think it's. You know, what they've done is they've used him to, you know, we all agree with what he's saying as far as, you know, his civil liberty stances. But when it comes, so everyone's thinking, hey, this guy must be right. But, you know, when it comes to this, he's totally shilling for the, you know, the elite.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you have, I believe it's very important to really understand who's actually running this show, you know, and who's running this show. It's a small clique of international banking families, and they've been at it forever. And you have these Jewish banking families, and you have these European royalty, most of which is the black nobility, and you know, the Merovingians and the what have you. And these people have intermarried, so it's one big clique. Right. And it's a small network. It's basically just a few dozens of families that, you know, that are at the absolute top of the food chain. And and these people, their power is economically, the basis of their power is economics, and the control of the money supply through the banking system. All the major banks, for instance, own each other, so it's just one massive cartel. And if you realize that, and if you realize that they're in this business for this 5 to 10 trillion per year wealth transfer through interest, and combined with the proceeds of the boom-bust cycle, then you realize that, you know, money is everything. The money system is everything. The monetary system is everything. So, you know, who somebody really is, where he's really coming from, these people will care nothing about all these wonderful stories about liberty and constitutionalism and choice and all these wonderful word constructs, which mean absolutely nothing. You have to look at what he's actually proposing, and the key issue always is, what is somebody planning to do with the money supply? And if he's just proposing a gold standard, of which it is completely clear that this will do nothing to address the wealth transfer through usury, then everything is clear. This is just a change agent. He's working for the same people. He must be, because otherwise he wouldn't be promoting gold. Simple as that.
Quick question from someone in the chat. They wanted to know what books and people does Anthony recommend people read up on?
Well, you know what really opened my eyes at the time was this brilliant Bill Still film. But obviously, it's a bit cheesy to promote that, because I think everybody has seen it or at least heard of it. But it's still a brilliant piece of work, and it's the Money Masters. And this provides a very good lesson in modern history and in what is actually driving the events in the world even today. And this film, I don't know if you know how old it is, Justin, but it must go back at least 10, 15 years or so. So it was really a visionary piece of work. And I think that everybody should see that. I also like this book by Alan Brown, which basically...
Web of Debt.
Web of Debt, exactly. Basically telling the same message as the Money Masters. And then I think it's important for people to get at least a little bit of info on interest-free economics, which can be obtained by reading maybe Silvio Gazzell or the work of Margaret Kennedy or another modern author, which is doing a good job in putting down the basics, as Bernard Littar. He's a Belgian guy, but he lives in California. He teaches in Berkeley. And you also have Thomas Greco, a very good author on what is called mutual credit, which is the modern way of creating interest-free credit-based units. And these are the probably... Oh, and nowadays you have a good book by Charles Eisenstein, Sacred Economics. I think that's a good primer on interest-free economics. And... So I think, you know, basically you need to have a basic grasp of the conspiracy, that it's an international banking cartel that is running this show. And on the other hand, you need to have a basic grasp of interest-free economics, and these authors provide this.
Right. How do you feel about Henry George and his, you know, and the issues as far as land and whatnot, and, you know, or just even his monetary policies and whatnot?
Well, yeah, I think that Henry George, I think his main issue is land reform. I think that's what stands out from his work. And up to a year ago, I was basically oblivious to land. But it turns out, and I think I really owe Keith Gardner and his Liberty Revival blog for this, but he really opened that up to me. And land reform is such a crucial issue, because you know, you guys are in the United States, so you have a great deal of land. I have a friend in the United States who is going to move to Michigan, And she just bought a plot of land there, an acre for $3,000. So that's not too much. But here in Holland, you will pay 500 euros for a square meter of land. So an acre would cost me $1 million here in Holland. And
that's crazy! Holy crap!
Yeah, that is crazy. So it's not as bad as that in all of Europe, but obviously Holland is a core country in Europe, and it's very densely populated, as is, for instance, England, which is equally densely populated. So the land prices there will probably be similar, and Belgium is very bad also. So land prices are just insane here, and the issue is that, you know, this land is all controlled by organizations and families that have been there for far longer than I have been. So I was born into a situation where the land was already taken, you know, because that's right. The issue with land. I mean, the mainstream economics and mainstream philosophy sells it as just another capital good, you know. But it is not, because land is there's a limited amount of land that has been provided by the creator, and you know, which all generations have to share equally in. And what we have is that the rich have bought up all the land a long time ago, and they use that to, you know, this control of the land to rip us off. But whereas they also are ripping us off with usury and the monetary system, they also use their control of land to rip us off, and they're saying, hey, this is our land, and you're born into this, and then now you have to pay us, you know? Well, what the hell is this? I mean, the land is everybody's, and nobody did make the land except for God himself, and what are these people doing trying to explain to us that it is their land, you know? It's not their land, and this is what Henry George realized, and he provided a fairly rational mechanism, I think. I'm not a specialist at this kind of thing, but I do know that he promotes taxing land ownership, especially if it's not used in a productive way, because that's another disgrace. I mean, you have vast swathes of land that are just lying there; they're not being used. Whereas people want land for all sorts of reasons, if not just food production.
Right.
So and this land is not used because it's more lucrative to lay waste of. What's the right term? At least unproductive.
Yeah, and I know what you mean. To sit there and not be. And of course, you know, there is some land that, you know, we view as vital for, you know, for parks or whatever. But for the most part, you know, there's plenty of land that could be developed and you know, and should be. Of course, you know, and the thing is, you know, and it will be under their terms, and that's the problem.
Absolutely.
A question from the chat came, what taxes do you view as justifiable?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that we can all agree that that income tax must go, and not tomorrow but now. I mean, that's the worst. That's the worst way. You have all these people, these mouthpieces on the TV. Oh, we're creating jobs, and we have this problem with unemployment. And at the same time, they're taxing labor into oblivion, you know. And I mean, you guys are in the United States; you're still pretty well off. But here in Holland, you're looking at 30-40% slapped on labor, you know. I mean, it's insane. And at the same time, you have massive unemployment and inactivity, and people having difficulty in sustaining themselves. And why is all this this labor tax necessary? 100 years ago, there was no labor tax. You'd be strung up the highest tree in the vicinity, you know, if you could suggest such a thing. But then in 1913, in the United States, the Federal Reserve Bank opened up, and that's when the income tax was introduced in the U.S. It was introduced a few decades earlier here, because Europe has been under the boot of the banking system for far longer, and taxes on labor is just outrageous and incredibly insane. And the most rational way of taxing the people is probably what was presented in the Protocols of the Learned Elves of Zion, which is a very instructive book, not just on the conspiracy, but also on how things actually should be organized. And they propose a progressive wealth tax. So they just take a small percentage each year of the wealth of each individual, and the richer you are, they will take more. And this is reasonable because there will be no income tax, and it's just it will in no way threaten your sustenance. It will just stretch your asset position.
Right. Now that's a big thing right now too. Of course, you know, you had the tax cuts over here that went from, you know, over 200,000 a year, going from 39% to 33%, and that's another big thing. You know, but in my opinion, a lot of that is a drop in the bucket as well. I mean, as far as, you know, we get into the massive theft that's going on and whatnot. You know, but just my opinion, I just think the whole thing is a scam. So, I mean, like you said, getting rid of the IRS would be great, and then after that, you know, once we figure out, you know, what we need to fix roads and what we, you know, infrastructure and whatnot, you know, because that money doesn't even go to that, you know, that goes right in their pocket. You know, another question I wanted to ask, you know, we all know elections are fixed and everything, you know, we all know, but, you know, this year we had Ron Paul running as a Republican, and I think that took the wind out of the sails of a lot of guys like Bill Still, you know, and other reformists and, you know, and other populists that could have ran. Now, you know, I think you agree with me when you say that was done purposely. He ran to take a flop, knowing that he wasn't going to, you know, get anywhere in the Republican Party. And, I personally believe that the elections are chosen way ahead of time. But, you know, what's your opinion on this? Do you agree with me that, you know, a guy like Bill Still that didn't get a fair shake with what happened? And you think a guy like him would have had a lot more exposure if we didn't have, Ron Paul running and everything else?
Oh, well, definitely. I mean, we must also understand that if Bill Still would run, he would not have the apparatus of the Republican Party behind him. So it would be more difficult for him to create this kind of momentum that Ron Paul has. But on the other hand, what made Ron Paul really big, of course, was being backed by Alex Jones and a few other libertarian outlets. I mean, that's what really gave him the momentum that he had. And obviously and evidently, a man like Ron Paul exists for no other reason than. And taking the wind out of the sails of the real opposition, which is badly organized, but the money power is really very effective in precluding it before it actually gets organized. And even before it gets a threat, they realize that there is some real that there are real grievances out there, and they know that eventually the monetary system itself will, especially in this massive depression that we're facing now. The monetary system itself will be under attack, and they have organized the opposition a long time ago, and Ron Paul is their main man, has been their main man. And if you look at the election, I mean, it was just a complete facade. I mean, it transpired that throughout the whole election process, Ron Paul never attacked Mitt Romney. So he was just messing up all the other guys, Santorum and all the other idiots, because they're all freaks. I don't even want to mention the names. But
it's like they had Romney picked to be their guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So him and Gingrich's job was just to take down the rest of them, pretty much.
Yeah,
Gingrich is somewhat on the same page as far as that goes as well. Nowhere near, someone in the chat also asked about the local currency you're setting up, what it involves, if there are any efforts by money reform pressure groups in Europe. You know, are you getting, are you getting resistance and whatnot from that, or what?
There is resistance, regulatory resistance. For instance, when I first started out in late 2000, I got confronted with the Dutch National Bank, the central bank. And I was running a telebanking system at the time, which is shut down because it was not conform their regulations. And it was quite clear that they were absolutely not sympathetic to the idea. And, you know, it would have been the easiest thing in the world for them to just give me a permit or, give me an easy deal. But they were actually looking to just shut the whole thing down. And they almost managed to do so, but at the end of the day, I'm still here. So creating new solutions, which are, you know, which are actually completely within the legal restrictions, which is still doable, because the main issues that have not yet been resolved in interest-free economics, and I'm in the process of doing that together with other with colleagues all over the world, of course. And you know, legal constraints always work with hindsight, so they don't make things legal that have not been done yet. So we're just innovating and finding new inroads to do what we have to do, and yeah, this can all be done.
Now, have you had a lot of people sign on? Like we had Wayne Walton on last week with his local currency, and he's, you know, said that he's had a lot of success with it. Of course, Ithaca's had a lot of success. These are still you know, somewhat new, but you know, can you see this possibly being something where, you know, can catch on? I mean, and you know, I mean, the whole thing here, I think, that's holding everyone back is the fact that, you know, the alternative media is so focused on pushing, you know, on shilling these other ideas out. But, you know, what do you think? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely, you know, personally, I'm absolutely positive that this is the way forward, and that this is the way of the future. I mean, you know, the simple fact is that government has been betraying us forever, and as long as we look back into history, government always has been problematic. And has always been basically an elite-sponsored meme. And the only way that the people are really going to liberate themselves is not by doing it all themselves, because we must face up to the fact that 80% of the population will always be at the lower end of awareness and of personal power. But what we need is just normal guys who are, you know, just break free from the mind control that they should be getting rich themselves over the backs of others, and and you know, start doing some decent work for each other, and start looking out for each other a little bit. And obviously, this can be lucrative and very satisfying and provide status and whatever. But we must work for each other, and I think that providing interest-free currencies, but also providing raw milk, high-end organic foods, natural healing. Hemp, why not? I quit smoking the weeds a few months ago, but
I mean, even for industrial purposes, look how many trees we can save.
It's a miracle plant. I mean, it can solve so many different issues, including energy and what have you, food. I mean, it's a wonderful plant, and it's just a complete and utter disgrace that that this massive war against it is being waged, and that in the United States almost 1 million people are incarcerated for smoking or owning it. So it's a horror.
And of course, big pharma has a big hand in that, as well as the
absolutely,
you know, the usual suspects.
Oh, and the fake drug war and everything else, and all the money they're making off of it, and all the corruption that's involved with it, you know.
Absolutely, but it's also really very telling to my mind that most people that I know that that are involved in some real truth seeking and are effective in it, you know, in the sense that they find out about stuff. It's really amazing how many of these people smoke weed.
I'm a weed smoker, man. So you know, Brian and I, you know, and I think most of the people, I think that's one thing that, you know, I think it's something that does open your mind to accept new ideas and get out of the paradigm. And I think, you know, there's been, you know, other people talk about some hallucinogens having the same effect. And obviously, I think that's a, you know, and I'm not big on hallucinogens. I don't get me wrong. I did a lot in my, you know, 20s and late teens and whatnot. But, you know, but to make a long story short, it seems like if you look at who's the people out here, it's the people that have, you know, have used a lot of cannabis and you know, and a lot of these other, you know, ayahuascas and mushrooms and whatnot. You know, I think that, you know, it's all natural. Yet we have something like alcohol that is totally makes people fight, makes you know, people, it destroys family unit by, you know, by how many different ways, you know, and it makes people do things they wouldn't do, you know, and if everybody just smoked weed, I think it'd be a lot better world.
Yeah. And it's absolutely not a coincidence that that it is being repressed so vehemently, where it's quite clear that it's not toxic. It does not make you go overboard in any way, and whereas with alcohol, as you rightly say, it's just insane the effects that alcohol has on society. Hundreds of thousands of people die each year as a result of alcohol abuse. The accidents that we have in traffic, escalating violence.
Seen an alcoholic try to recover? It's worse than a lot of drug users. Bad. Like with the shakes and the sweats and all that. It's really bad.
Very bad. I mean, it can really make you very dependent on alcohol.
If you were going to get in,
Go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to ask you one more question related to monetary. I know you where you are, it's 4:35 in the morning right now, so we're going to have you off by 5, so you can get back to sleep. One thing is, and a lot of people don't understand is that, you know, these people like Ludwig von Mises and a lot of these, other famous Austrians have come from, Rockefeller money and whatnot. I just wanted to bring that up. And, you've uncovered a lot of this stuff. So, I mean, you know, if anything, I think that does a good point of showing, you know, what side they're on and whatnot.
Well, we'll have to get back to the discussions that I was having with the Daily Bell at the time. And, at some point you realize that you're being misrepresented. They're using clever debating tricks to sideline you. They keep you busy. They come back every time with slightly slanted, slightly rehashing old stories, etc., etc. So then you start thinking, Jesus, what the hell is going on here? Am I being, this guy screwing with me or what, you know? And I was working with Meme Hunter at the time. I started working with Meme Hunter at the time. And we started doing some digging in the backgrounds of Austrian economics, and we started to find out all sorts of really very fishy connections. And it basically transpired that it all started with an organization called the Volcker Fund, which was generated by a wealthy Jewish businessman who left a legacy, a trust fund with millions in it in the 30s, just to generate a reactionary ultra-right ideology to counteract communism, and which was on the rise at the time, of course. And this Volcker Fund basically was languishing a little bit, but eventually the nephew of the old man came into the organization, and he really started to make waves. They started to import to look into ultra-right thinkers from Europe, for instance von Hayek. He was the first first guy that they laid their eyes on, and this Road to Serfdom book of his. And they made sure that it ended up in every library in the United States. And from then on, they really started to disseminate these ultra-right ideas. And it's all about capitalism, denying usury as a problem, the boom-bust cycle that von Mises, obviously, the narrative that he created. Von Mises, he was imported by John Rockefeller himself. And he was given a grant, many grants. He basically survived as a result of Rockefeller handouts. One of the Rockefellers, I forget which one, I think maybe it may have been Nelson. He explained later on in life that he actually considered himself an Austrian economist because he was so close to these people. And if you start looking at it, you find out that all these guys, von Hayek, von Mises, Rothbard,
Friedman,
exactly. They're all associated with the Volcker Fund, got stipends from the Volcker Fond, and there's also this Montparnasse Society, which was created by Volcker Fond alumni. And these people, they generated 8 Nobel Prize winners of economics. And obviously, these Austrian economists, they are always saying, oh, we're a fringe movement and we don't get any attention and blah, blah, blah. And of course, they'll get far less attention than mainstream economics and Keynesianism. But they do have 8 Nobel Prizes, so they're not so fringe, you know? And so it's really very, it's without a doubt that Austrian economics has been financed A to Z and has been basically created from scratch by the same people that created Marxism, Keynesianism, and what have you. And it's not just the Volcker Fund, because you have the Koch brothers. Justin, you mentioned them a couple of times. The father of the Koch brothers was instrumental in creating the John Birch Society, which is also very important in the libertarian community, although it's not hardcore libertarianism. It's very closely associated. Right. And if you look even further back behind the curtains, you can actually find people like Alfred Kohlberg, and even Bernard Baruch is directly tied to the early libertarian movement of the 30s and the 40s. So it goes way up to the command structure of the international banking cartel with these guys. I mean, Bernard Baruch is one of the most powerful men of the 20th century, and he was directly involved in all this. And nowadays, if you, because of course, right, this is all
another thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Justin.
Oh no, definitely not. Another thing I wanted to bring up was the John Birch Society. Of course, now, if you look into them, you know, you have a bunch of Knights of Malta and Jesuits that are, you know, the you know, it was founded by Robert Welch. You had you know, the guy, who's it nowadays, the head of it nowadays, another I believe Georgetown alum, and you know, and another, I can't think of his name, normally I have it on the tip of my tongue, you know, and it just shows, and these are all from the same people, and we're, you know, and you know, going back to the Salamancan Jesuits that actually, you know, yeah, you know, the they actually started, you know, started the Jesuits, Ignatius of Loyola and all of them. So I mean, it, you know, it's really, it just shows that the money power, you know, is still alive to this day, rearing its ugly head behind these groups that, you know, a lot of people think, hey, the JBS is great. They're, you know, they're against Agenda 21. They're against the New World Order, but yet, you know, you look into their ties and you see, you know, who's backing them, and who, you know, they're, every one of them, you know, they're all out of Georgetown or Fordham or one of these universities, or, you know, or one of these Jewish Zionist power brokers or whatever, you know. So, I mean, the main thing is that, you know, all these groups are just controlled opposition.
Absolutely. And recently, Meme Hunter had been writing an article about the current control structure, because what we've been doing earlier this year, and people can read about this in the Faux Economics page that I have on realcurrencies.wordpress.com. I have the entire series of articles blowing these elitist ties out of the water. So it's, I think it's very instructive for people to have a look at that. But Meme Hunter recently came up with some basically devastating new data that he picked up from some other blogger. And which shows that nowadays it's all centered around what is known as Agora Incorporated, which is a publishing house, and it transpires that many of the famous hard money outlets that we know of today, including the Daily Bell, but also the Daily Reckoning, and even the International Forecaster, from the later Bob Chapman, who is also very famous in this business.
Yep.
Is related to this Agora Incorporated publishing house, which is run by a man called Lord Rees-Mogg. It's wonderful that these people call themselves lords, but this guy is controls this outlet, and he's a direct associate of the Rothschild family. She basically has dinner with these people, you know. So he's very close to them. And this guy was used to be in the governing council of the BBC. He's an ex-editor of the Times. So this just shows that at the top, the libertarian media are controlled by exactly the same people as the mainstream media, literally the same people. And these ties are just so blatant and so obvious and devastating, actually. I mean, it's insane that in this day and age of the internet that these people can still get away with this nonsense.
You know, it's just insane, too, that so-called free thinkers cannot, you know, put these things together. But, you know, and that's the thing. It was so hard for me even to, you know, to comprehend that the whole thing was, you know, a setup. And, of course, you know, we've seen it, of course, with the 9/11 truth movement. You know, we've seen it with so many other things that there's gatekeepers trying to stop, you know, new theories from coming through. This has happened, you know, it's happened in every movement. You know, but the fact of finding out that the, you know, the hard money, as you know, as you call it, was total bullshit to me, was one of the bigger things. It's a hard pill to swallow for the people that, you know, that listen to the Bob Chapmans and the Max Kaisers and, you know, and all these other types that guys you're talking about. And I think that's going to be, it's really an uphill challenge from now on, because we have so many people that are somewhat awake, but yet they don't know where to find this stuff. And that's why, you know, we're really trying to get the information out, you know, to you and other people like you, and, you know, and it, to where, you know, we're coming up with other solutions besides, you know, this stuff that we've, you know, seen as a fraud. So, I mean, you know, definitely wanted to, you know, I'm glad we had you on. We got another like 10 or 15 minutes left. I definitely want you to definitely want to plug your sites and whatnot. I was trying to think of if there's anyone else that wants to ask any more questions.
Yeah, why go ahead. We'll take our last break right here. We'll take a quick 3-minute break. We'll come back and then you can get all the plugs ready and we'll plug everything. And if we have any phone calls, we'll take some phone calls before we go off.
Okay, wrap up.
How's that sound?
Just great.
All right. Cool. So everybody stick with us. You're listening to Dose of Reality Radio with Brian Stavely and Justin Cook. I'm your host, Brian Stavely, along with my co-host, Justin Cook, and our special guest today, Anthony Miguel. We got about 10 minutes left before Anthony has to get off, and we're going to close the show out. If anybody wants to call in with any questions, the phone number's right there on the site, 978-735-2224, or you can use Skype from anywhere in the world for free if you have Skype. And you can Skype the show, or you could just add us to your contacts and call us that way, The Real News Online. 10 minutes left, guys. What else do we need to, are we forgetting, or we need to really hammer home here at the last run here?
I don't know. Anthony, is there any other points that you'd like to make? Anything you'd like to, you know, any distinctions you'd like to make, or, you know, you mentioned earlier too, The Money Masters, which is a great movie. Yeah, it's about 3 or 4 hours long, but it's really worth the watch. You know, and it just shows, just, you know, over the years, you know, how they've manipulated the money and the different systems and what that they've had. You know, another thing is the Secret of Oz was also pretty good. But besides that, you know, is there any other researchers that you recommend as well?
No, not really. I mean, obviously, well, there's Dick Eastman. Hang on, there's Dick Eastman. He's a very fringe kind of guy, but I really appreciate his work too. But for the rest, there is not really that much. Basically, I did it with these sources that I mentioned earlier and that you were just mentioning, Justin. And I think it's also fair to say that we shouldn't make it too complicated, because at the end of the day, it is not so complicated. Money really is a very simple subject. The reason why there are so many books is because people are trying to obscure the message. That's why so many people are writing so many books about it. And you basically only need to get the basics right, and then... if you understand usury, and if you understand how easy it is to produce money in a mutual credit kind of environment, because then that's maybe something that would be nice to say in these last few minutes, is that if we talk usury, I mean, it's very important to understand that we can do completely without. It's so incredibly cheap and easy to produce money. Even, you know, these Federal Reserve notes that we all know, it's just paper with ink slapped on it. I mean, and that is just what it is. Money drives derives its worth from the agreement to use it as such. It's nothing more and nothing less. So it really is very easy and cheap to produce money. That's why we can create local currencies, regional currencies. And so the solutions are there. And you had your man Wayne Walton on last week, and he's just another inspiring man, I think, because he's just doing it, you know. And that's what we should be getting into, just do it. And if you get a chance to pay with these units, absolutely do so, because it's just a wonderful way of taking your purchasing power out of the monetary system that we have now and to use it in a more constructive way in a regional currency kind of environment. And that's what it's all about, you know, using your real life energies, which is your income, in a more positive way. And yeah, stop buying at Walmart, stop parking it in a bank, you know, make your money work in a more positive and constructive way. And these are the challenges for the now, actually, not for the future, but for today.
Right. Trying to think. Oh, a quick question is, you know, I started to sneak this in on you. What do you think about Tarpley? You know, I mean, I personally lean to the side that he's, you know, somewhat controlled opposition, of course. But I did like the fact that he actually went on Alex Jones and debunked a lot of this, you know, the Ron Paul stuff. Do you think he?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, Tarpley is way ahead of the pack, way ahead of the libertarian pack in terms of economic knowledge. I mean, that's completely clear. I mean, what he proposes, he's got this 5-point antidepressant. Yeah, he's very close to the Russians, exactly. And he basically promotes what you could call a Hamiltonian banking system. I think the main problem that I have with his approach is that it is a little bit what the libertarians would call statist. I would like to see more decentralization. But it is at least that, you know, it would be devastating for Wall Street and devastating for the international banking cartel if Tarpley got his way, and it would immediately end the depression, and he would provide full employment almost overnight. And yeah, so I mean, Webster Tarpley, I do have some issues, but he's
It's better than the status quo.
Way better. Way better than both libertarians and what we have now.
And that's just like the Zarlanga plan, which wasn't perfect either, but it was something where I think it would have done us a lot of good at the time, you know, even right now it would end the depression and get jobs going and whatnot, you know. So I mean,
absolutely.
Go ahead.
Your man Dennis Kucinich had a bill in Congress, HR 2990. I think that bill is still alive, or languishing maybe, but alive. And that's basically a fairly rational and classically populist approach to the monetary system. And we need to get something like that in, and that would be a major improvement. But the point is that will not happen. I mean, the idea that the state is going to print its own money, or will do so in a way that is beneficial to the population at large, is it's just naive. Right. It's just not going to happen. So it's no use, to my mind. That's where I'm coming from. That's how I look at it. It's no use to waste too much time on these measures, because they're not going to be implemented. But we can, as you know, as free men, we should not be looking at the government to solve the problems. We should be solving them ourselves. And regional currencies are a very viable option to do so. And that's where I think that the real chance is to break the monopoly on the money supply by the money power.
And barter is the oldest thing there is, pretty much out there. Barter's
absolutely. And the challenge now is, because you know it's easy to create basically primitive barter units, but they have limitations that are basically, you know, too much for local businesses to cope with. But we need to have, creative ideas to create solutions for these problems. We don't have enough time now to go into that, and it's a bit of a specialist subject. But there are obvious problems, and these can be solved. I'm absolutely positive of that. In my own work, I am solving these problems. And we need a couple of men and women out there using their own brains and creating viable solutions that will work for a large part of the population. And it's doable, and we must do it.
Right. Well, you know, I want to say thank you for coming on. I hate to use the word fan, but you know, a big follower of your site since, you know, about a year ago, and I definitely learned a lot from him. And I think that, you know, what you're doing is great, and I just, you know, want to thank you, and definitely would like to have you on again at some point. Besides that, I don't know. You want to say any closing words? Why don't we? For anyone that's listening to the archive, let me give out where you could find Anthony. That's realcurrencies.wordpress.com, thedailynell.wordpress.com, Nell spelled K-N-E-L-L, and then recoveringaustrians.wordpress.com. And, you know, that's where you can find his work at. And really, he's pumping out the articles over there, and there, you know, there's a couple other good guys that he's working with that are, you know, on the same page. So I think, you know, we need to, you know, hear out some of these other things before we, you know, end up down this Trojan horse road of this gold standard or whatever else they have planned for us.
And Anthony, we really, I don't know if people out there know. I know some people do, but the time zone difference is so much. It's like 5 a.m. for you right now. So you actually literally set an alarm clock to get up and do the show with us, so we'll be on at our time. And we really appreciate that. That just shows the dedication, you know.
It was great being with you guys and having this opportunity to have this chat with you. And I hope it was enjoyable and maybe even instructive for the audience and for the people listening.
Yeah, oh, thanks totally. A lot, and we'll shoot you a link when the archive's ready. It'll be ready by tomorrow, and then if you want to share
that's
with
great.
Anybody or whatever, you'll have
Yeah, I'll put it on the site. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, man, thanks
okay,
a lot for coming
on. Okay, have a good
on.
One. Bye-bye, bye-bye, take care. Okay.
All right, everybody, you've been listening to Dose of Reality Radio. I'm your host, Brian Stavely, along with my co-host, Justin Cook, and we will be back next week. We'll post in all the groups and up on the website on which day. Not exactly sure yet, but it will be sometime during the middle of the week at 9 p.m. So, Justin, anything else you want to say before we close out?
Nope. I pretty much said it all, but thanks for listening. And, you know, anybody that wants to find out more, like I said, gave you the links. And, you know, I don't know, hit me up on Facebook or whatever. Hit up Brian or comment on the site. Thanks for listening, guys.
Dear Mom, if some people came by the house looking for me, I'm innocent of anything they say I do. Now, I don't know when I'll be able to write you again, but I will be back to California to see you. Your son, Ice Motherfucking Q.
I need a lawyer. This bitch named LaToya. Say they looking for ya. Got to get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, right.
This bitch dim the lights.
You niggas spend the night.
Bust a quick nut. Got the fuck up and got on. Cause this is the same street I got shot on. So God bless. Dumb Paula, double S. I got the holler cause I'm smoking on double press. Tweaking. Niggas be leaking. Information. Got the feds seeking. Incarceration.
Outside Colorado, by the dead, for his wife. petition for this extradition. I'm on the mission, fucking fight them, dodge and ditch them. I got to kick rocks, I can't pick locks. I'll spend the rest of my life in a shit. My boys, Utah to Illinois, set me poised so I can infiltrate all 50 states. Can't wait till I'm back on my feet. Switch and shake this bitch in her sleep. Low key, you feds can't see me all up in D.C. with strike number 3 clowning. Made a little stock to get a little cock. Now I got niggas banging in Little Rock. I'm going back to Cali, westbound with the strikes. Don't give a fuck who's on the mound or the mic. I should have known when I seen that motherfucker in the lobby looking like he wanna rob me. Federal, don't like no black hetero. Sexual, intellectual, tried to turn me into a vegetable. And I'ma sue all black and blue when I come to hand.